Welcome to the Reason Roundtable, the weekly libertarian podcast that, unlike Morning Joe, still goes on after a near-miss assassination attempt on Donald Trump. I am Matt Welch, joined by Nick Gillespie, Peter Suderman, and Catherine Mangu Ward. Hello, everyone.
Howdy.
Is it too soon for a happy Monday? It's just Monday. Yeah. It's maybe not a happy
Blue Monday.
Make every Monday happy, Peter, as you well know. We're going to get into this political violence in this country of America here in a moment. But first, a word from our sponsors, good friends over at Students for Liberty.
The most important ideas are those debated on college campuses. Think about how many different fringe concepts initially spawned in the academy that are now prevalent across society. F.A. Hayek noticed this phenomenon. The ideas developed in academia soon spread to the rest of society. That's why Students for Liberty supports students like me in spreading the ideas of liberty on campuses. As a coordinator with SFL, I've hosted high-profile speakers to discuss the pressing issues of the day, published magazines and articles to spread pro-liberty ideas, and helped organize and attend conferences on campuses around the world. SFL connected me with partner organizations, and thanks to SFL, I've been accepted to internships at the Competitive Enterprise Institute, National Review, the Cato Institute, and will start as an assistant editor at Reason Magazine this summer. My name is Jack Nicastro, and I'm one of the thousands of volunteers from the SFL network building a freer future for people across the globe. Visit spreadliberty.org to discover how you can contribute to building a freer future at school and beyond.
Okay, on Saturday, America came within an inch or two of being in an extremely dark and uncertain place after a 20-year-old sniper shot the former and possibly future President Donald Trump in the ear at a rally in Butler, Pennsylvania, in the process killing one attendee and seriously wounding two others before himself being killed by the Secret Service. Trump very iconically raised his fist on the way off stage, yelling, "Fight, fight, fight," as blood ran down the side of his face. As of 11 a.m. Monday, when we're recording this, we still don't know much about the shooter, aside from his name, that he appears at first glance to be a stereotypical loner weirdo, was a registered Republican, but had given money to Democrats, was using his dad's gun, and reportedly had explosives in his car. As per usual, in just about every high-profile act of violence, you can bet that some of even those details that I just cited will later be proven to be misleading or even flatly untrue. All of this comes before the Republican National Convention, which begins tonight in Milwaukee. Trump is already there, preparing to announce his vice presidential pick as soon as today, and has said that the shooting has impelled him to be to rip up his speech and to be more conciliatory and unifying. Predictably, there have been many fingers of blame pointed at the Secret Service for failing to establish security around the perimeter, at local law enforcement for spotting the shooter but failing to engage before he pulled the trigger, at Joe Biden and the Democrats and the media for comparing Trump to Hitler for 8 years, libertarians and other Second Amendment enthusiasts for easing the availability of guns, and some have even laid partial blame on to Trump himself for adding to a climate of political hysteria and violence. Catherine, we're going to dive into some of those controversies, but first let's give you the 30,000-foot question, which is, what does this assassination attempt say about America, and what has now changed about America?
So obviously, I, in times of crisis, always turn to a source of comfort and warmth, which is Ayn Rand. And there does seem to be, it might be hearsay, but there does seem to be a quote from Rand, which was floating around a little, that just says, "This is America. This is not the way we do away with presidents. We vote, we don't kill people." And that's right. I mean, this is deeply, deeply troubling because we really do have a very clear procedure for what we do about presidents we hate, and it ain't this. And I think that the very, very rapid scramble to blame everyone for everything does not speak well of how this is going to play out. It can't be everyone's fault. And I think now and always it is best to put the blame first and primarily with the shooter.
Nick, the pinned tweet on your Twitter account is, and I quote, "Cover your ears, Fred Young. Jesus fucking Christ, the Ohio State University should be deeply embarrassed by this alum. You were referring to J.D. Vance, the U.S. Senator, and possible, I think, likely vice presidential pick. After Vance had said that Biden's, quote, rhetoric led directly to President Trump's attempted assassination, end quote. Why do you think Vance is wrong?
Because to say that the rhetoric that Trump is Hitler, which is actually not exactly what the Democratic Party was saying or Joe Biden was saying, but to say that that rhetoric led directly to Trump's assassination attempt is wrong. And we should always beware of politicians who are starting to do not only tone policing, but ultimately it's going to be kind of speech regulation and things like that. We have been down this road before. Political rhetoric is often ugly. It's always divisive. People have been accusing Trump of being Hitler. People have been figuring the murder of Donald Trump and all of that kind of stuff. And yet the responsibility for the shooting is with the assassin. And as you were alluding to, Matt, and I think Catherine might have as well, we're going to find out that this person, whatever he is doing, it's disconnected from the political rhetoric of the moment. And if we are supposed to say you can never go, you can't be wildly invective in your political rhetoric, where does that end up? We went through this with the Gabby Gifford shooting where Sarah Palin was accused of causing that assassination attempt. She ended up being shot and damaged. Several people were killed in that shooting. And it turned out that her rhetoric had nothing to do with that. And in fact, the reality had nothing to do with that. And I am willing to bet right now that something similar will obtain in this situation.
Just quick follow-up, Nick, that, you know, we, you and I grew up in an era of a lot of political violence in the late 60s and early 70s. I wasn't really much around in the late 60s, but that seemed to kind of end with the assassination attempts on Ronald Reagan in 1981. Kind of feels like it's coming back. There was the congressional baseball shooting. There was an attack it's been kind of forgotten about by Lee Zeldin here in New York, a knife wielder came at him. And now we have this. We have also seen in the last, you know, 8-9 years on both sides, Jay Rosen warning, I think an increased apocalypticism in rhetoric. Are those things unconnected?
Yeah. And I'll point to your point on the 2023 American Value Survey, which is the most recent one. It was released last fall. 23% of Americans agreed with the idea that you may have to resort to violence in order to save our country, and that's up from 15% in 2021 among Republicans. It's at 33%, up from 28% among Democrats. It's at 13% versus 7%. What I would argue, what is fundamentally different about the 70s political violence and the whole decade was one, because, you know, there were two attempts, one right after another against Gerald Ford, if you'll recall, also disconnected from any kind of larger political motivation and things like that. What was different in a time like the 70s was the Cold War, the continuing and escalating political violence and terrorism around the globe from groups like the IRA and the PLO that were being funded by the Soviet Union or doing, you know, something in the context of the Cold War and a twilight struggle between communism and the free world. We don't have that now. There's no question that, you know, rhetoric has been getting more and more apocalyptic. I've always spoken out against that. I think political violence always needs to be condemned without exception and without qualification. But I don't think that what we are going to see coming out of this is that the assassin was convinced by, you know, the new Republic cover of Trump as Hitler. And I think we should be very careful when we allow a politician like J.D. Vance, and there are other people on the left and all of that kind of stuff, when they start to say this rhetoric, if you, because what he actually said was that Biden saying that Trump is a fascist totalitarian, this is the end of democracy, if Trump wins a second term, that is illegitimate political rhetoric. No, that's wrong.
Peter, there's been a lot of criticism at the Secret Service, even while praising the agents who helped protect Trump immediately up at the podium, with the important caveat that none of us here are security experts in that business. But this looks pretty bad, doesn't it?
Well, it doesn't look good. I mean, it's... It's very strange to see the overhead maps of the site where the shooting took place and see that there was very clearly a low building rooftop that was within sight of where the president was going to be speaking. And that rooftop was outside the security perimeter. There was no one posted on it. There were no snipers there, actually on that rooftop. And you would I am not like a campaign trail reporter for the last several decades, but I've read multiple accounts from people who have covered presidents speaking at campaign events for years now. And they've all said, that's pretty weird that there was no one posted on that roof that the shooter was on top of. So again, I don't know exactly what happened. I think I'm somewhat more sympathetic to some of the complaints about, well, you know, they were warned several minutes in advance. Yes, in some ways, like this was probably preventable if they'd taken action more quickly. And so when I say I'm somewhat sympathetic, it's just that I can see, look, in the heat of the moment, you see a guy up there. Maybe does he have a gun? It's actually quite hard to tell. And there are some reports, though, that, you know, the Secret Service snipers held off for very briefly, even though they'd tentatively ID'd him, because, in fact, sometimes they're looking through a scope and they see a guy trying to watch the president through a telescope. And it's hard to tell a telescope versus a gun at distance and that sort of thing. We need a lot of answers here. I think this pretty clearly did represent a security failure of some sort. Exactly what happened, we don't know yet. And it's probably going to be weeks, if not months or years, before we have a complete rundown, a complete investigation into what happened last Saturday.
Catherine, let's have you take the ritual bullet for the gun control critique here. Isn't there something wrong with a system that allows 20-year-old creeps to get access to AR or whatever the hell?
No, there's not. That system is guaranteed by our Constitution, and the vast, 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 vast majority of people who own that very same model of gun use it for fun. They use it for recreation. They use it in a safe and responsible way. The argument here is the same as the argument for why the war on drugs is a bad idea. The costs of prohibition would be incredibly high, would probably not prevent stuff like this, and would violate people's constitutional rights. So, nope, this isn't about gun control. I do fear that one possible political outcome here, because Trump has always been a squish on guns, is that we end up with a Republican Party that is more receptive to certain types of gun control measures. And I think that would be a bad thing for the country.
So just one thing to note real quickly here is that the AR-15 style gun, the platform gun that was used, has often been a sort of a target of gun controllers, gun banners, sort of as a, you know, part of the assault weapons bans and everything. But if you somehow or another both banned the sale of new AR-15s and all, again, somehow or another, managed to get all AR-15s out of private hands in a period of time and were able to successfully do that, you would still have an awful lot of sharpshooting rifles that might even in this case have been more accurate. You would have millions and millions of those rifles, especially out in rural Pennsylvania. And the idea that you can stop violence by targeting one particular type of gun, mostly, as Jacob Sullum has pointed out over the years, just because it looks scary, is really pretty bizarre.
I also want to say, just in our discussion here, we've used. You almost can't avoid it when you talk about gun control. Every headline is a pun. Every reference has a double meaning. You know, take the bullet, target, etc. Our language is very, very full of war metaphors. Our language is very, very full of metaphors that have to do with violence and, by the way, food. That's basically what our whole language is built on.
Also, and sports.
Sports is just violence. Sports falls right under the violence subheading. And you know, this is worth keeping in mind as everyone goes hunting for people who used words that sounded like maybe they wanted to kill someone, as we try to look for who's responsible for this assassination attempt, because all of our words sound like we're looking to kill someone. And I just think that's super important to keep in mind.
Just like to issue a correction, baseball is not violence, because as George Carlin taught us, baseball is played in a park. Nick, I spend a lot of time trying to teach my 9-year-old, especially when traveling on airplanes across the country, not to catastrophize constantly about every possible worst case scenario. However, we're about 1 inch away from a pretty worst case scenario, which is that an assassin blew Donald Trump's brains out. And I'm sorry for the explicitness of the language, especially given the 50-year-old girl dad who died, which is just horrible. But maybe it's worth like preparing ourselves mentally as a precautionary measure. A wake up call, perhaps. What would have happened, or you know, what do you worry about at the extreme end of the possibility parameters here?
What I worry about is what the philosopher Giorgio Agamben would call a permanent state of exception. That we've already seen this constantly. Matt, you and I in the Declaration of Independence talked about how, and you know, which came out in 2011, 2012, so a long time ago, we had already been governing constantly lurching from one emergency to another in the 21st century. And that has only continued and even accelerated since then. And that's what I worry about the most, is that if something like, if Donald Trump had been killed, to be honest, even in a possible way, if Joe Biden dies before the election, assuming he's going to be the Democratic nominee, that people will say we have reached a point now where the normal rules cannot apply and we have to go into a state of exception everything is suspended. That's what worries me the most, because we have already in many profound ways, if uninteresting ones or unexciting ways, you know, we no longer do budgets the way that we're supposed to. We no longer do so many basic ways of governing that are supposed to be done through democratic kind of election and transparent movement and, you know, open meetings and things like that. That's something people would say, okay, something has changed fundamentally here. The fact is, with assassinations as well as attempted assassinations, we've known how to keep moving. And I think we will. And I'm heartened. I'm heartened by the fact that Trump seems to be, he was going to be striking a different note tonight than he might have absent. And, you know, one of the things I also want to say, among all of the obscenities in this, is the people who are blaming Trump for somebody trying to kill him. You know, this is where the recursiveness of stupid political rhetoric, which has been dumber and dumber and dumber my entire life, gets totally out of control, where it's like, you know, who's to blame for somebody trying to kill Donald Trump? Donald Trump. You know, it's like, I don't know.
I'm going to stick up for recursion, and I'm going to find ways to fold that into my day-to-day life. Peter, in the wake of any kind of situation like this high-profile political act of violence or just trauma, you will typically see, and you are seeing right now, a lot of non-lefties point out that there is a pretty glaring media double standard at play with the way that it is treated, talked about. And you just, you know, Nick alluded to the Gabby Giffords shooting before. You know, famously, Sarah Palin was blamed for this somehow because of a Facebook ad. It didn't make any sense then or now. And even though Republicans are, some of them are switching sides, like J.D. Vance, more commonly you will see people just say, if the shoe had been on the other foot, we'd have it be an entirely different national media conversation than we see right now. Is there something to that? Do you think the media is living down to its kind of expectation as being unable to have a kind of even-keeled a way of presenting facts in a precarious circumstance?
I think the best way to think about that question is, somewhat annoyingly, these comparisons are always a little bit tendentious, right? But to just imagine, what if exactly this had happened, except it had been Joe Biden and not Donald Trump? Imagine the coverage that you would have seen. Imagine the tenor of the rhetoric after that. Imagine how many stories, how many op-eds, how many tweets there would have been from the the Democratic Party establishment through, but then through the media and the media's, the Democratic Party's base in the media, about, you know, how we need to talk about how we have a right wing violence problem, how we need to talk, right? It just like they would have instantly made it a simple partisan political issue before we knew anything except, oh, there's a bullet that grazed, you know, that grazed a presidential candidate or a president's ear, right? And I think that, like, it again, we don't know because that's not what happened, right? It's always, counterfactuals are always a little bit dicey inherently. And sure, maybe it wouldn't have looked like this because we don't, in fact, have a clear sense of the shooter's motivation here. But I do think it's fair to say that we would have had a different response from the media and from mainstream institutions that have a kind of left-leaning valence if it had been a Democratic candidate, if it had been President Biden rather than Donald Trump. That said, I think a lot of what we have seen from the media, including from major organizations, you know, the MSM that people complain about, has been pretty responsible in a lot of ways. They were, the relatively accurate news mostly got out quickly, especially after about the first 90 minutes. Yes, I think there were some bad headlines in that first hour, some bad things that said, oh, look, maybe the Secret Service is saving Trump from falling or something like that, I think was a CNN headline. Please fact check me. I'm not quite sure that it might have been a different outlet. And so there was, but the first hour of something like this is always incredibly difficult to cover. And within 2 to 3 hours, it was pretty clear what the outlines of the situation were. And we were getting essentially factual and cautious, but steady drips of news as it was coming out. And so I think in some ways the media has covered this pretty straightforwardly, and we know what happened, and we've gotten good information. On the other hand, I do think that the discourse, the tweets would be different if it were not Donald Trump who had been grazed by a bullet, but someone with a D after their name.
Catherine, to put a button on this segment, I know that you want to abolish most parts of government, but let's pretend for a second you didn't. Should RFK 2.0 get a Secret Service detail?
So I do think that this is such a case of Hanlon's razor with the Secret Service, if I had to guess, right? This is always assume that things can be explained by incompetence rather than conspiracy. Not to say that conspiracies don't sometimes happen, they do, but my guess is the Secret Service screwed up. Not the Secret Service is part of a vast web of conspirators. And so I think with that in mind, like, sure, give everybody Secret Service details, but I assume at least one reason that we don't do that is because maybe our resources are not, adequate to the job. So it's just a fair question to be like, are we giving RFK Jr. Secret Service protection and then the major candidates have less? I don't know. I have no idea how that staffing works. But if that is the case, that's a fair question. I think that, you of course get down to the question of other independent candidates, right? Like, obviously people have a habit of assassinating Kennedys in a way that makes RFK Jr. particularly wary. But what about Chase Oliver? What about Green Party folks? What about other independents? There's just, there's always going to be another marginal person on this question of Secret Service details. So, sure, give them protection, but
we need the auxiliary Secret Service staffed solely by Vermin Supreme to dissuade people with his boot head. Yes, Nick.
There is, George Wallace was crippled. He was paralyzed by an assassination attempt while he was running for president. That both highlights the question of who deserves a Secret Service coverage, but also what are the motivations of assassins? And it is, to go back to, where we started with this, Matt, tying in the work of literally a number of people that you can count on one at tops two hands over the course of American history, and tying that into the rhetoric of the moment is a ridiculous connection to make at any given point in time, especially if you are doing that in order to police and control and silence critics or people making political speech, which happens all the time. There was there's a fantastic piece, which we can link to in the notes, by Joseph Campbell about how William Randolph Hearst was blamed for the assassination of William McKinley because Ambrose Bierce wrote a quatrain attacking William McKinley. And it turns out that the assassin of McKinley had obviously never read that, may not have even been able to understand English properly. So let's, when it gets to the question, not of is political violence bad? Yes, always and everywhere in a democracy. When political violence becomes the way that you change things, we are no longer living in a democracy. But when we start talking about how we have to monitor our thoughts and change the way we speak in order to avoid the actions of madmen, we've gone off in the wrong direction.
So people need to watch what they say about dangerous political rhetoric.
I think that there was a it's a good point, Nick, but there's a climate of quatrains back there that maybe the assassin was.
Yeah, no, well, it was the climate of right wing hate. I mean, literally, this is what people were saying when Kennedy was assassinated. It was the climate of right wing hate in Dallas that killed Kennedy.
A communist pull the trigger. Yeah. It is crazy. All right, we're going to pivot to Joe Biden's big boy press conference here in a moment. But first, a reminder that this episode is sponsored by BetterHelp. Friends, you ever feel like you need to get something off your chest, like PTSD from previous major party political conventions? Guilt over enjoying your 16-year-old's hilariously inappropriate political TikToks? Or just the fatigue of carrying more familial responsibilities than you think your little shoulders can bear? Well, it's time to unclog those emotions, perhaps with a licensed professional who can help you break down those burdens into a more manageable battle box. That's where BetterHelp Online Therapy comes in. BetterHelp is an easy-to-use, super flexible, entirely online therapy service that has helped many listeners of this podcast do the necessary release work in order to more smoothly get through their day. All you have to do is fill out a quick questionnaire, get matched with a therapist, and if you don't like the first one, just swap them out for a second. Let therapy help you get it all out with BetterHelp. Just visit betterhelp.com/roundtable right now to get 10% off your first month. That's betterhelp.com/roundtable. Do it today. You'll be glad you did. All right. It already feels like one or two lifetimes ago, but President Joseph Robinette Biden II on Thursday held his first press conference since his miserable debate performance against Donald Trump. The 45-minute exchange with reporters, which is an extremely rare occurrence during this presidency, was greeted by many in the press as a return to form, like a Paul McCartney 1980s record, even a masterful foreign policy performance. We will talk here about the style points, which is what everyone was obviously keyed in on. But I thought for fun, we might even look at the substance, which was supposedly super great. So whether it's at the press conference or at his next day big second agenda unveiling speech at a rally in Wisconsin, or even his kind of brief remarks in the Oval Office about the Trump assassination attempt. So, Catherine, why don't you lead us off? What's one policy-related aspect to what Joseph Biden has been uttering into cameras since Thursday of last week that is of interest to our listeners?
I think the continual insistence that we're somehow going to get back to a version of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict that existed maybe never, but maybe 20 years ago is the thing that was so striking to me. He's still a two-state solution guy. He's still talking about that conflict as if everything that has happened since October 7th isn't real to him. And I think that it highlights his age. He said his views a long time ago, and he's not really going to change them, and he's not really available for new inputs. But it also just reminds us that maybe that solution was never workable. Even when he was young and vital and had all his brain cells to think about that solution, it's not clear that that's the one he should have come to. So the continued insistence on the two-state solution, which is very clearly not a solution at this point, and maybe never was.
Peter, what's a chunk of substance that caught your eye?
So President Biden has been running on a whole big policy agenda that includes a bunch of stuff like passing the PRO Act. But the one I want to focus on here is that he keeps saying we need to end medical debt. And now, this is an outgrowth of a proposal that the Biden administration has been pushing for several years. Press releases going back to at least 2022, talking about how they're actually going to prohibit credit score companies from taking a look at medical debt when they put together your credit score. But now we see that they want to go a little bit further than that. And the details are not entirely clear, but there's a release from Kamala Harris's office, actually, that talks about, this is a quote, leveraging public dollars to purchase and eliminate medical debt. Now, again, we have no real details on that, but it sounds like that means they're going to spend a bunch of money to try and get rid of this debt. We don't have a dollar figure on that. And this really seems like a combination of Biden's approach to healthcare generally, as well as his approach to student loan debt, where you sort of take something where, you know, you just spend a whole bunch of money. It's not quite a big government program in the sense that, say, Obamacare or Medicare are big government programs, but these are big spending packages or sort of big spending initiatives that are designed to pull debt out of the system. And look, nobody likes having medical debt. And in fact, paying medical bills is kind of annoying because the doctor's office will never give you the bill while you're right there and just let you put your credit card down and pay it. They send it 6 weeks later after promising that, right? Like, it's crazy. It's totally frustrating. It's incredibly frustrating. I have been frustrated by a bunch of these bills. At the same time, like, when you go in and get medical service that you are supposed to pay for, that is an agreement to pay for it. And it sort of seems like this is an exaggeration when I say this, but this is like a baby steps towards kind of nationalizing the whole medical financing, right? Like that is what Biden wants to do without actually doing it. And he's going to take every little tiny step that is short of a big step around the edges, at the margins to try and just say, well, you know, we're just not going to have any kind of real kind of private payment or system of private payment. Because what does private payment rely on is when somebody says they're going to pay, they actually have to pay out of their own pocket, or the insurance company that they are paying has to pay out of their pocket. One of those two things. It's not that the government steps in some years later and buys that up for you. And so it is, I think it's of a piece with what we have seen from Biden on student loan debt and on healthcare generally, which is, let's just see if we can spend a bunch of money, have some giveaways, and we're benefiting the middle class.
Nick, what's a piece of policy that Joe Biden has talked about in his public remarks over the past 5 days that has caught your attention?
My thing is the way that he substituted his vice president, Kamala Harris. He substituted Donald Trump, as well as he, switched who runs Ukraine and who runs Russia. It is hard for me to get to the substance issues, Matt, because the style is the problem. The reason he was speaking in all of these instances was to reassure at least Democrats, because he's obviously not reassuring anybody else, that he has at least some of his marbles. And he failed at that spectacularly, which you can read through all of the coverage. But beyond that, on a kind of meta substance level, he could have explained that he represented a return to normalcy. There are ways that he could paint a very positive picture about the past 4 years, and that he came in at one of the most fucked up moments in American history. And actually, almost all major indicators are better now than they were when he took office. And he was incapable of doing that.
So I think it's worth going back here, if we're going to talk about style, to the point where Biden says, I think it was during one of the debates as he was running, I am the Democratic Party. Because what we are actually seeing here as the debate about Biden's age and infirmity is going on is the reverse, is that instead of the Democratic Party being a kind of body and he's the head and just they're just doing what he says, and the party has become Biden's wishes, it really seems like the reverse is happening. No, it's not just that it seems like the reverse is happening, it's that Biden's staff is explicitly, as far as I can tell, at least through back channels, making the argument that Biden's infirmity doesn't matter that much because the staff apparatus, the White House, all of the bureaucrats, they're in charge and they can make the decisions and they can make all of this work. And that's not how it's supposed to work. We didn't elect those people. It is Biden who is president and who is running for president. And we have a situation in which the actual president, they're kind of making the argument that it's not quite that he's an empty vessel, but that he just sort of does what, that the staff, right? Like the decisions are made by the staff, and he can just sort of come in and say, okay, no, maybe choice A rather than choice B, but it's fundamentally a staff operation. And that is not how it's supposed to work. And it is really strange to see that, especially after Republicans made that argument during the initial Trump years. And Democrats was like, that's crazy. That's bad. We shouldn't have a president who can't be president.
I think, another way of saying that, Peter, that gets to what is actually going on in terms of politics is that Trump is the Republican Party at this point. Whatever he says, we're at these two parties no longer have they don't represent coherent coherent group of interest groups. But whatever Trump says becomes what Republicans believe, and they fall into lockstep. Biden does not have the charisma or the power or the energy to do that with the Democratic coalition. The Democratic coalition is not willing to fall in line, which is one of the reasons why on things like Israel, for instance, and a variety of policies, he has spent more money. I mean, this is one of the things that his champions say. He has passed more major legislation in 4 years than Lyndon Johnson did. He's like FDR, and it's still not satisfying large parts of the Democratic coalition. He can't pull off what Trump has pulled off.
Building on Peter's point, a couple of things that I found jarring about this sort of the puppet president sense was that his literal first words of the press conference is that I got this list here that I've been given of all the people I'm going to call on. I didn't like that too much. At some point he was talking about how he was talking about his staff and that they basically kind of leak too much information. And then he said, oh, I'm going to get in trouble with Jill on that. And he just kept bizarrely cutting off his thoughts in mid-sentence by saying, anyway, which really gave the impression that he saw someone in the crowd making the finger against the throat like a gesture when he was rambling on about chip factories in South Korea or Hong Kong or wherever the hell he was talking about. So all of that was kind of distressing on the actual policy front, rather than some of his slogans, such as we're going to end corporate greed. He really said end corporate greed. It's crazy. And also control guns, not girls. He just sort of screamed out towards the end. But actual policy, he at some point said, we no longer live in a Cold War universe. The post-war order is kind of over. And so what's going to replace it? And I was in their audience going, hey, I'm glad to hear that conversation. Of course, he didn't say anything about what's going to replace it. He just says, I have an idea, and the opponents don't have an idea. I think that is a brilliant encapsulation or succinct encapsulation of what's wrong with the kind of fatigued Atlanticists who are trying like hell to fight against the populists such as Donald Trump and other people in Europe like Viktor Orban. They just say that we got to keep doing this because it's been what we've been doing forever. And they are not articulating a new vision that has anything to do with reconnecting with a kind of democratic legitimacy that these institutions need, or else they are going to wither away one by one. All right. Previously teased, actually before that, just quickly, based on all of that, and especially based on his kind of cognitive performance, including his battle box comments about Donald Trump, repeated that phrase I think three times, and they even included it on their Twitter brag feed. Is this man
just disappointed that this is not going to give us like a street battle rap off, right? That every time I've heard that phrase, it's like I want to see Step Up 2, but with Biden and Trump AI'd into the main roles, right? Doing the breakdancing.
The place I went with it is my son is at Battle Bots camp this week, where they like build the little machines and smash them into each other. And that I'm like, let's settle the presidential election that way, honestly.
Is he Catherine Biden, meaning not your son? is he fit to be the president, let alone the candidate for president?
I don't know. It seems like absolutely everyone on the table is bad. Is he worse than the other people who might be president?
That's not the question.
I still don't think so. Are there any of them fit to be president? No.
Not the question.
I go back to my previous.
President Brain Cheese, is he fit right now, given his state, to be president? Yes or no? What say you, Catherine?
No. No.
Nick, do I hear a no from you?
No, I think he is. I think because by definition, he is if the Democratic Party nominates him, period. I would love to see both him and Trump before every debate or maybe twice a debate. They have to do one of those online CAPTCHA tests where it's like, okay, mark all the squares that have bicycles in them. And if they can pass that, then they can continue to talk.
I don't think we're worried that they're bots. That, although, again, battle bots would be a good way to resolve this presidential election.
He is. Matt, he is brain dead, but that is not the question. The question is, you know, can he be elected and could he run the country if elected? Yes. If the Democrats put him forward, he's qualified.
Yeah. I don't think I would vote for a second term Woodrow Wilson. Sorry, Catherine, can you repeat that?
Second term Woodrow Wilson, is it like first term, second term? I don't know, you know.
You like Woodrow Wilson's early stuff?
Not sure.
You know what? I like Warren G. Harding's second term. That would have been the ultimate presidential term.
I think Nick's answer, I actually disagree with this. Fitness is not determined simply by the will of the voters or the nomination of the party here. You know, we talk a lot about the presidency as a kind of the person who sits atop the regulatory apparatus, the policy influencer decider, right? Who, even if he is not casting a vote in Congress, his party in Congress is following his lead. And that is obviously true. That is a big part of being president. But the other big thing about being president is that that job in the constitutional system resides in the person of one man or one woman, of one individual, for a reason, which is that in moments of crisis where time is of the essence, that is the person who gets to make the insta-snap decisions. And one of the things we are hearing from Biden, it's not just that he seems slow or out of it sometimes in public appearances. It's not just that he has bad days. It's that he is complaining that his staff is overscheduling him. He was tired 12 days after an Air Force One flight to Europe. And he's saying, well, maybe I need to not have events after 8 p.m. I am sorry, but you sometimes might have to be president and make a big decision after 8 p.m. And if you are telling us explicitly that you are not capable of doing normal stuff after 8 o'clock in the evening, you are not fit to hold the office of the presidency.
Wow, Peter Suderman sounds like a fascist enabler.
But we do. We have a constitutional process in place for that, right?
I don't think that either of us are saying if elected, he was elected unconstitutionally. The question is he capable of doing the job to a standard that we would like to apply? And I think that's clearly no.
And Trump is that?
No, I don't think he's capable either. Okay.
Let's pivot to Trump. As teased previously, the Republican National Convention begins tonight in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Reason has a crack team of reporters. I'm not talking about the drug necessarily. On the ground, keep mashing the refresh button at Reason.com for their reports. In advance of this particular political infomercial, the GOP has, for the first time really since 2016, updated its party platform. So let's go around the table and talk about some of the stuff that's in there and what it might say about a second Trump administration, the future of the Republican Party, and various impacts on the country and libertarian values and preferences and so forth. Peter, why don't you lead us off?
Yeah. So there's been a change to the way that the platform describes how the Republican approach to Social Security. And the old platform said basically, you know what, Social Security is in trouble and we're going to try to do something about that because it's in trouble. Like maybe we're going to rejigger the benefits and the financing mechanisms so that it actually has the amount of money that it needs to fund its obligations. That was the old position. And maybe you could argue, okay, maybe they shouldn't be doing that. Like that's, they're just trying to solve the math problem. You know, the entitlement's just too big and it's terrible, right? Like that's maybe not the most libertarian position in the world, but like they at least were like, you know what? The trustees are like, we're going to run out of the fake money that we've been using to pay for this. We should probably have enough fake money. And now they're like, no, we don't even need to have the fake money to pay for it. We're never going to do anything because it's sacred. And this is, okay, they don't quite use the word sacred, but that is basically the position that Trump has taken here and that has dragged the Republican Party towards in the way that Nick was talking about, is that the party just follows whatever it is that Trump said. And Trump has been saying since he started running for president in 2015, you know what, we can't do any, we would never touch Social Security. We'd never change the benefits. Because, you know, our seniors are too important to us. And that is now the platform position, is we're not going to do anything about it. But guess what? If you don't do anything about it, something gets done to it anyway, which is it runs out of money and can't pay all of its bills. And so as far as we can tell, the Republican plan is to let Social Security run out of money so it can't, so it can no longer pay all of its bills.
Catherine, you're a lady. Was there any lady-related bits in the platform that you found of interest?
I don't know. I'm not really that interested in the lady bits. I wish I hadn't said
you know
that
you're missing out on
sentence.
A whole world of fun, Catherine.
Okay, everybody. I actually did not do a control F for any lady words. I did do a control F for the words debt and deficit and would love to talk about those, but it's up to you because you're the moderator, Matt.
Yeah. Thanks. I was just going by what people said on Slack, but you go forward and say whatever
you
want.
Oh, thanks. Cool. Okay. So there's only one use of the word deficit. It refers to trade deficits, which, as we've established before, Donald Trump doesn't actually understand the difference between budget deficits and trade deficits. So that's cool. The word debt
doesn't
appear.
Would you say he has a cognitive deficit?
Shut up. Shut up.
Yeah. Wow.
The word debt doesn't appear. Chapter 3, Build the Greatest Economy in History, is a section of this platform. And, you know, there's some decent stuff in there. Cut regulations, make tax cuts permanent, you know, champion innovation. Nowhere do we mention where is the money that we're going to use to run the government coming from. Nowhere do we have any kind of hint that that might be a major issue that a president in 2025 would have to deal with. Also, champion innovation is the last section, and there are 3 points: crypto, AI, space. On the one hand, I love it. On the other hand, what? What?
Okay, but Catherine, what if that was the whole platform? What if it was innovation and it had those 3 bullet points and nothing else?
Maybe we shouldn't be using the term bullet points. That's my platform for Reason Magazine in the coming years, but it should not be the Republican Party's platform.
Nick, did you see anything of the platform worth discussing?
Yeah, you know, Covfefe shows up at least 15 times. This is one of the functions of, being able to digitally search documents. Mm-hmm. What I looked at was the immigration policy, because this has been heated. Trump's absolutely ugliest rhetoric, I think, has always been about immigrants. He barely got off the escalator before he, you know, laid into all of those Mexican drug dealers who were also disease ridden. Coming across the border. On immigration, their main points are they're going to secure the border, which I think makes sense. We need to have some kind of order, around the country. We need to have some way of knowing who's coming into the country and things like that. Then in all caps, they talk about they promise to carry out the largest deportation operation in American history. This goes back to, you know, apparent vice president or a highly likely vice president, J.D. Vance, has been talking about, you know, we need large-scale deportations in the country. We have a history of large-scale deportations in the during the Depression of Mexicans, as well as in the wonderfully named Operation Wetback in the 50s, when something like 1.5 million Mexicans were deported. If they're talking about breaking the record there, they're going to be talking about getting rid of more than 1.5 million people from the country forcibly in an age of social media and in an age of due process. That will be a very, very ugly and horrifying spectacle to behold. So I'm deeply worried about that. The Republican Party, the way that it has kind of lost its way on immigration, is one of the most deeply disturbing developments of the past 30, 40, 50 years, even at this point, or whenever, you know, since 1980, certainly. The other thing that they did say without any details is that they were going to prioritize merit-based immigration. That might not be a terrible thing if, in fact, they were talking about increasing, like if there was some specifics to say we're going to increase the ability of people to come here legally and be able to work and live openly. Trump, on the call-in podcast or whatever the fuck it's called, the one with the Silicon Valley guys, did
all in.
Thank you. Did say that he was okay with the idea of giving people who get associate's degrees, bachelor's degrees, or advanced degrees automatic green cards. That's actually a good start on immigration liberalization. It should not be the whole thing by any stretch, but. The immigration section is deeply worrying because it plays to the worst elements, not just of contemporary populism, but historic populism in America.
So I did the Control F exercise as well. And some words that did not show up anywhere in the document, NATO, Russia, or Ukraine, nowhere in the Republican Party platform. If you do the word foreign, it almost all refers to the aforementioned border issue or tariffs. The exception is down near the bottom. We see that Republicans will strengthen alliances, okay, ensuring that our allies must meet their obligations to invest in our common defense. So, okay, that's a reference to NATO, and Trump will browbeat a little bit more strongly than before, perhaps, than he did for people to pony up. And then they also say, and by restoring peace to Europe. That's interesting. Where's the war in Europe, and how are you going to restore it? They don't get to the how. In general, the critique, and this is pretty typical of not just Trump, but just kind of the Andrew Jacksonian approach to foreign policy, is to say that the Biden administration's weak foreign policy has made us less safe and a laughingstock all over the world. So it's just we're going to do peace through strength. We're not going to tell you anything else more about that, except rebuilding our great military and such. So I found that of note. The emphasis on foreign policy is not much of an emphasis on foreign policy in the party platform. All right, let's go to our end of podcast, what we have all been consuming. Nick, I understand that you were attending a conference involving a lot of libertarians over there in Las Vegas. Do you wish to give us a report?
Yeah, sure. I just came back from Freedom Fest, which is the annual gathering of mostly libertarians and conservatives, typically in Vegas, where it was this year. The previous year it was in Memphis. Next year, apparently, it's going to be in Palm Springs, Matt Welch.
Oh, hey.
So maybe you will be the person who
let's not get excited
is the biggest face of freedom and reason at that. But Freedom Fest had a slate of very interesting speakers covering the spectrum of many things. Steven Pinker spoke there. Matt Ridley, Michael Shermer talked about atheism and science and rationality. Ice-T, the former self-styled pimp, military veteran, and longtime actor and rock act, the head of Body Count, the wonderful late 80s kind of thrash metal band, kind of hip or kind of rap, I'm not sure how to quite qualify it, but he and Kennedy of MTV and of Reason and of Fox News had a great conversation where Ice-T talked about both the freedom of speech. He was subjected to a lot of soft power and jawboning by federal officials, as well as culture people in the late 80s, for the song Cop Killer. He also is a big Second Amendment rights guy. That was fascinating to hear, you know, a black actor, military veteran, rock performer, cross categories in a way, you know, somebody like Killer Mike does that today, et cetera. But it's always interesting when they blur the categories. The actor Rob Schneider, who's been a long time vaccine critic, we'll put it, also spoke and was pretty funny. RFK Jr. was there for the second year in a row. So it, you know, what Freedom Fest did was it showcased all of the kind of factions and fractures within the broad libertarian movement. I am happy to report that Reason, of course, was greatly represented wonderfully by Jacob Sullum, who talked about his forthcoming book on the parallels between gun control and drug control. Robbie Suave gave a fantastic talk about the falseness of the whole misinformation kind of industrial complex. I talked about what I call the agony of abundance, about how many of the arguments that we're having in America come not for, because of scarcity of resources, but rather the fact that we basically are now arguing over symbolic aspects of everyday life and the meaning of life and things like that. One of the things, and I'll leave with this, is that we a lot of people who I talked to, besides the ones who were trying to throw acid in my face, were very extremely positive about Reason, and even some of them, even some of the acid bathers, were what they like about Reason is the optimism and the forward, not just the forward momentum, but the forward orientation to how do we make the world a better place, and how do we make it more open rather than more kind of truncated, more closed, more pessimistic, and more narrow in what people are able to do or how we're able to conceive of the good life and how we interact with people. So Freedom Fest, there are probably already ads going up for buying tickets next year. But if you want to be among a broad swath of people who are in the libertarian movement, it's a good place to go for a few days.
Ice-T is a great underrated screen presence. One of these guys who's just always welcome in, you know, usually in a supporting role. And in 1995, he had a fantastic year. Like for me personally, his year was good for Peter Suderman because he co-starred in both Johnny Mnemonic alongside Henry Rollins and Keanu Reeves, and also in Tank Girl. And like that is a pair of accomplishments for the middle of the 1990s. Just a great year.
The next year, his
only movie credit is for something called Frankenpenis.
Yeah. That's the John Wayne Bobbitt story, by the way.
I'm still waiting for the Rosenpenis pick, yeah. Spinoff of Fletch to come out.
The other thing that is great, Google Ice-T for... there used to be, this was a very popular meme series of where he would be explaining some kind of fake new drug on Law and Order that was about to destroy the city. And they would be calling, you know, they call it Holiday Inn Kombucha. You know, you take one sip and suddenly you're running naked down Hollywood Boulevard, things like that. It's quite good.
Catherine, what did you consume?
I both listened to a bunch of episodes and also appeared on a podcast that I want to recommend. It's called Chatter, and it's from the folks, the Lawfare folks. They have a whole bunch of different podcasts, but this one tends toward the Gillespian interview, I would say. There are several different hosts, but my pal Shane Harris is one of the hosts. And he and I talked about libertarianism and national security. So plenty on that podcast to make everyone who has opinions about libertarianism and national security mad. But just in general, great selection of mostly like new books that they interview the authors of. I do also like that my episode appeared immediately before an episode about librarians. So you can choose like the libertarian-librarian dichotomy is with us always. It's also a really good name for a podcast, Chatter, because you chitter chattering, but also it's about national security stuff. So Chatter. Anyway, I recommend it. And if you want a starter episode, you can start with the one that I'm on.
Very good. Peter, what did you consume?
Well, I really just want to talk about Johnny Mnemonic and Tank Girl now, but
no,
but
no, I'm not
going to
do that.
Yeah.
So as I've mentioned on this podcast, I've been back and forth between the North Shore of Boston and DC this summer. And so I watched the 1998 romantic comedy Next Stop Wonderland, which is set in the North Shore of Boston and very specifically all along the blue line of Boston's T system. Like all the different spots on the, like many of the stations of the in, on the T line, which I have been riding a bunch to get back and forth between where I live and or sort of where I've been up here and the Alamo Drafthouse where I go see movies downtown. Like they appear in the movie. The end of the film is like the two sort of main characters get together on Revere Beach, which is America's first public beach, or at least that's the legend, and like realize how beautiful it is just right here, just a little ways north of Boston. It's so cute in so many ways. It starts in downtown with Hope Davis's character being left by her boyfriend, who is played by Philip Seymour Hoffman, a young, crazy, still like making his way up Philip Seymour Hoffman. And he's an environmental activist. And what's so great is at the end of the movie, he comes back and is like, environmental activism, it's a scam. They were just trying to, save the land for the Native Americans and they just built a casino on it, right? He learns that it's all, everybody is just out to build something on their land. You know, you save it from the developers and well, it's just a casino in the end. It's such a great time capsule in so many ways. All the clothes, all of the just sort of the like it really looks like the late 90s looked, the apartments. Sam Setter, the political commentator on Air America, co-stars in this movie. He is one of the actors like at like 22 years old. The plot is about dating apps except before dating apps. So the plot is that that Hope Davis's character, her mom places what are those ads in the back of the newspaper? Personals ad. And a bunch of guys are like, we're all going to call this girl. And the first one to get on base with her wins the contest, right? So it's just like, you could make this movie today, except about the apps. And it is just a reminder that that dating has always been difficult and people have always been upset by it. And like, it's not the app's fault. It's just the fact that like being young and single and kind of hopeless and like, not in love, like it sucks and you feel sad and forlorn. On the other hand, if you discover that at the end of the blue line, there's a beautiful public beach, maybe you'll find your true love and he'll be a marine biologist because it's 1998.
All right. I am recommending a piece of art related to an acquaintance of mine, a colleague, who died over the weekend, Evan Wright, age 59, committed suicide, sadly. He was a great journalist, LA character, although I don't think that's where he was living at this point in his life, but worked for Hustler, most notably at Rolling Stone. And his most prominent piece of work, and I recommend that people check out all of his work wherever you can find it, was a book, one of two or three that he wrote called Generation Kill. It came out in 2004. My recommendation is not that book, which I haven't read, but I've read some of the Rolling Stone work on which it was based, but rather the HBO miniseries that came out in 2008. It is probably my favorite single HBO miniseries or like miniseries, post Roots and the original Shogun or whatever it was that we were watching back in the days.
Centennial, Matt.
Centennial. Gosh, you know, you're not wrong about that. I still bite sticks, Nick, just for sport.
Oh, yeah. Escanel. Qu'est-ce que c'est, Jacques?
It
just
is
like my giant puppy.
Just every single person that I have seen who has watched it, or I know who has watched it, and who served in the military, and particularly who was deployed, say it's their favorite piece of art related to that. Like it gets the tedium of the deployment, the kind of like BS conversations, late night philosophy, ragging, just a bunch of stuff in there. It kind of gets the pace of that so well. He was a really great sort of neutral observer. He helped with the creation of that series, but it really is such a terrific piece of work. I think it's about 7 episodes or thereabouts. And like all great pieces of audiovisual art, Catherine, it's ultimately about management. Arguably one of the best ones out of all of those, right up there with Apollo, whatever that was, and Mad Men. Generation Kill is just a remarkable meditation on management. So seek that out first, maybe work backwards through the Evan Wright catalog. Very sad day for a lot of us to hear that he wasn't able to keep going. And that's that. Good luck, everybody, with this political week and the climate that we're all living in. We have lots of podcasts. I don't know if there's some that are going to be Republican convention themed, but go to allofthemreason.com/podcasts. Nick, I do know that we have some New York events that you'd probably wish to familiarize people with, right?
Yeah, the one that I want to talk about is on Tuesday, July 23rd, and it's happening downtown in Manhattan. It's going to be the premiere of a documentary about the Backpage, the founders of Backpage, who were found guilty under misbegotten federal prosecution. One of them committed suicide en route to this conclusion, and the other is waiting to be sentenced. But on Tuesday, July 23rd, we're going to be showing that. It is done by Paul Dietrich and Elizabeth Nolan Brown, who will be speaking on an after panel about Backpage and what the prosecution means for freedom of speech and also freedom of sex. She'll be joined by Caitlin Bailey of Old Pros, a sex workers activist group. That you can get all the details at reason.com/events. And you can also sign up for our New York City events at reason.com/newsletters. At the NYC events. But this July 23rd event will be really fantastic. It's an incredible documentary about a very important, not simply attempt, but actually successful, you know, kind of action by the government to shut down free speech in the name of helping people that will inevitably end up hurting more people. So please come out.
And already has. So if you like what we do here as an organization, please consider a tax-deductible donation at reason.com/donate. We will catch you next Monday. Goodbye.